Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Science Fiction and Fantasy. This episode features Ben Hatke, author and illustrator of the Zeta the Space Girl series.
Hi, this is Dan Nexon, and I'm speaking to Ben Hatke. Ben, are you there?
I'm here.
Thank you so much for coming on the podcast today.
This is fun. I was looking forward to this, and I'm glad we finally found time for it. Glad we finally connected.
I should give some background. I actually met you at a book signing or a graphic novel signing at Big Planet Comics in College Park, Maryland. And I'd randomly taken my daughter there because I promised her to go to the comic book store every couple of weeks so she can use it as a library and eventually we buy something. And we walk in and they say, are you the here for the signing? And I said, well, what signing? And they say, well, it's Ben Hatke of Zeta the Space Girl.
I'd forgotten about that. That was more of a random encounter. I'd forgotten that that you hadn't familiar with the book yet.
Well, I actually knew the book. I just had no idea that you were there.
Oh, okay.
So my daughter was super excited because she loves Zeta the Space Girl, and she'd just gotten Legends of Zeta the Space Girl on pre-order. I said, well, do you want to go get it signed? And she did the typical kind of 8-9-year-old, I'm sort of embarrassed about that. But I wound up staying there for about 4 hours, I think, looking at my iPad while she hung out with your daughters.
Yeah, that was one of the first ones I brought my girls to. So that was actually a lot of fun. And they had somebody new to talk to, which was great.
Right. And I hope we'll talk about later. Your older daughter is a terrific artist. And so I think she motivated.
Yeah, they were all drawing together there for a bit.
So my daughter, I think, became much more interested in improving her craft as a result. So that gives you some of the setup. You are primarily known, I think, to the community and to a wide community as the author, illustrator, and producer of the Zeta the Space Girl series. Could you tell us a little bit about Zeta the Space Girl?
Yeah. There are a series of three books now about they're graphic novels, so they're comics. The format is comics. They're, you know, long-form, book-length comics, and they're about a girl who's essentially, the series is about a girl who's kind of world hopping, hitchhiking her way back to Earth, trying to get back to Earth after an adventure has brought her out into the far reaches of space, and that's kind of the broad thing. It's about trying to get home. The books start with the first one is Zeta the Space Girl, which kind of tells the story of how she ended up so far from home. The second book is more about is kind of the fallout from the first adventure and about identity and about travel. And then the third book, which is not out now, but I finished and turned it in, it should be out in the spring, is called The Return of Zeta the Space Girl. And those three books form a bit of a trilogy. And I have an idea to do a second trilogy down the road, but for now those three books form a complete sort of cycle or story.
Well, my daughter's going to be very excited to find out that the third book is coming out in the relatively near future, it sounds like. When is it due out?
I'm not exactly sure of the month. It's set for spring of 2014, which seems like a long way away. Especially, I did turn it in some months ago, and this is like that time when you're just like you're excited about something, and you can't really just share it yet. I think if I was left to my own devices, I would just start sending people PDFs of the book. Cause I want to share that, this story with people. But yeah, so it looks like, January, February of 2014.
Hmm. Sounds like the production cycle for graphic novels is a lot like the production cycle for academic books. It takes forever.
Yeah, it can be long.
Except for the difference is people actually want to read them. So you mentioned earlier, I sort of asked you to talk about what Zeta the Space Girl series is. You sort of said, well, it's a graphic novel, it's a comic book. I know that the term of art now is to refer to these kinds of bound stories that we used to call comic books as graphic novels as a way to legitimate them, you know, as sort of the legitimate their literary quality.
Right.
You could talk a little bit about that issue, about the discussion about what people, you know, the work that you produce should be called.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've accepted the term graphic novel. I think that there was a lot of discussion and a lot of argument over what do we call these books that are coming out, these, you know, comics with a spine, a lot of different ideas. And I've just come to say, like, I think the term graphic novel has won the day. And, you know, we still call what a lot of people call films, we still call movies to differentiate them from the, you know, the whatever came before and the talkies and the, from the old radio programs. And I think, you know, at a certain point, a term just wins the day, and that's what you get. And everybody understands that this is what we're talking about. When I think about a graphic novel, you know, we've already used the term comic book to refer to something that's like, that's basically a pamphlet. What we call comic books are basically magazines. They're stapled. They're very thin. They come out, they're serialized stories. And I think graphic novel, what I like about the term is it says, like, here is something in comics format that does what a book does. It tells a story from start to finish, and you can sit down and read it like you would a book, and you're not waiting for the next installment. I mean, unless it's a, you know, books do series, but overall, a graphic novel does what a book does, or does what a book sets out to do. And that's what I like about it. It's funny because there's some overlap, because a lot of times they'll bind together comic books, a series, like, you know, they'll bind together like a run of Green Lantern and call that a graphic novel, when, I don't know, it's kind of that gray zone. That's maybe if they all function together as a book like story, or, you know, a little bit like Dickens did, serializing his stories in newspapers and then binding them as a book. But I like the term graphic novel, and I think it fits well for something that should be on a library shelf. So that's where I am with the term graphic novel, and comics is just like, the word goes to me, comics just means, this format of telling a story with sequential art. So when you open up a graphic novel, what you get is comics. When you open up a regular novel, what you get is prose. You know, when you open up a picture book, you get something that's a little bit different. You get prose and illustrations. So anyway, those are my feelings about the terminology.
At some point, we're going to have to cycle back to talk a little bit more about the plot and what's so compelling about the Space Girl. But I do want to push you a little bit. You mentioned the difference, or the somewhat ambiguous difference, between, say, a picture book and a graphic novel. And the Zeta series is what you referred to earlier, what you told me is an all-ages graphic novel. And what exactly does that mean?
So for me, so were you talking about all ages, or were you talking about the difference between comics and picture books?
Ah, so I've melded two things together and therefore confused you. I thought the best way to kind of start thinking about or talking about the difference between a picture book and a comic book might be to start with the fact that if it isn't clear already from the discussion of our daughters, that Zeta is, you know, something that is read, I think, predominantly by children.
Right? Yeah.
And you know, one of the things that you can see if you go online to one of your websites are these wonderful pictures of little girls who have dressed up as Zita for Halloween.
Yes.
With these homemade costumes, which are just amazing. I mean, I love
them. Yeah, that, I get a lot of joy out of that. I started getting those at Halloween last year, and it just, I've started a little file of them, and it's just so much fun. I think I'm going to post more pictures every Halloween.
And we first encountered, I think the first Zita book we saw in a, it was in the graphic novel section of a independent toy store, which also has a significant bookstore.
Okay, that's great.
So, in a sense, you know, I encountered this as this is a graphic novel that is appropriate for my daughter, right?
Mm-hmm.
And but when we'd been sort of having our preliminary discussion, you know, before we started recording, you know, I had called it a children's graphic novel, and you'd said that you'd prefer the term all ages, and so
yeah.
I wanted to have you talk about that a little bit. What makes something different between a children's graphic novel and all ages graphic novel? And then I thought that would be an interesting way to get into what makes this different from, say, an all ages picture book or a children's picture book.
Okay. So all ages is a term I actually take kind of seriously. I really like, to me, instead of writing children's books, I'm trying to write all ages books, for two reasons. First of all, what I'm writing is also what I think is cool. I mean, I'm not just writing these for kids. I'm writing these for me, and I'm trying to put things that I think are cool into these books. And you know, I'm a grown up man, but I really like this type of story that I'm telling. These are stories from my heart. And I like, you know, filling worlds with creatures and jokes and things like this. But to me, all ages, like the Pixar movies do a great job of telling all ages stories, where, like, if you go to see the Toy Story movies, you know, if you're 45, if you're 25, if you're 15, if you're 5, you're going to go in there and find something that you like, and something that's for you, or something that everybody can smile at. And that's what I mean by all ages. I really like it when I find, you know, adults that are picking up these books and enjoying them. And that's the kind of story I'm trying to tell, not just stories that are solely geared towards kids. And I don't think, you know, I think the best stories are all ages. C.S. Lewis has this quote about, you know, when I was a child, I loved fairy tales, and then how's it go? Eventually, when he was old enough, he went back to fairy tales and found he enjoyed them just as much. But for a while, you're embarrassed of it. But I feel like, you know, I'd like to tell a story that, you know, nobody would be embarrassed to read. Although, you know, like, probably 18-year-old boys still not carry around Zita the Space Girl. But it'd be cool if they did.
Well, it's funny because, you know, there's a cheap way to do all ages, which is, I think, the sort of Pixar imitator way, where you have a story for the children, and then you throw in pop culture references or
yeah.
use an innuendo for adults. And then there's the sophisticated way of doing it, which is to tell a story which is multi-layered, right? Which has
exactly and respectful and that you can approach it at multiple depths. I really like that. Yeah, I respect it so much. And you're right. I don't want to do the stories where on one hand you're talking down, and then we'll throw in a couple, you know, jokes to keep the parents awake, or, you know, make them chuckle as they read down to their kids.
And I think that's definitely I mean, I think you've been very successful with the first two books of the Zita series. I'm just, right now I've got Legends of Zita the Space Girl in front of me, and I'm looking through it, and it strikes me that there are things in it. So one of the things that happens very early on is that there is a discarded, recalled, it says on the package. Imprint-O-Tron, robot who is sort of discarded in the trash heap. And this robot, it's not giving away too much to say that this robot will eventually imitate Zita.
I think
find Zita attractive for some reason.
She takes on Zita's likeness, yeah.
And takes on her, you know, and winds up looking virtually identical to her. And that, there's something, you know, both kind of moving about that, but also very, I think, for a child, ominous in a way.
Mm-hmm.
There's a point when it transitions from sort of where you're very sympathetic to this character to suddenly it becomes a little bit more of an object of fear,
right?
And then goes back to an object of sympathy.
yeah.
And you know, I think that that's something where you can imagine. I mean, I know because my daughter's read this that, you know, there's a whole wave of kind of that sort of element of the storyline conjures up very intense kind of a very intense emotional experience. In part because children don't necessarily know all the tricks of storytelling that adults have become jaded to.
Right.
But at the same time, you know, adults can appreciate what's going on in terms of a whole set of impulses about wanting to be like something else, about this the way in which you visually track emergence from the trash to a position of being a figure who's viewed as heroic and has lots of attention and is not at all in a trash heap. So I think that's sort of a – not to kind of – wax about that for too long, but I think that's a wonderful example of how you can get this kind of multi-layered all ages element into a very sparsely told story.
Yeah, and I think you shouldn't we shouldn't sell the emotional depth of children short. I mean, they have a tremendous emotional depth, and they can key into a lot of these different things that are going on. And just, you know, some of it's new to them, so they feel it more intensely. And that's one of the reasons why you have to tread carefully, you know, because just the lack of multiple experiences with these same story beats and emotions and things like this can make it so that something that is creepy and frightening to, you know, it's like these nerves haven't been deadened quite as much. So something that's, you know, like even emotionally ominous could be felt more deeply or more, could be more raw to them.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean like, you know, stories are even that much more important because it's our way of interpreting things. And that's why they're super important for kids. And, I don't know. I think too many children's stories or even what we are trying to be all ages stories, sell the younger audience short a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Don't give them enough credit for just picking up on, like there's just things that are alluded to, like loneliness in the second book, especially, you know, Zita's, really doing this journey on her own, even though she does have her friends. And sometimes, you know, I try to just draw that out with quiet moments and facial features. And I think kids are really, I think the younger part, members of the audience, are key into that just as easily,
mm-hmm.
you know, as we do, maybe.
No, I think that's right. I mean, what I was alluding to more was that adults have this kind of meta knowledge. So we know that if we open something that's all ages appropriate, that while there may be very sad things in it, that there will be an outcome which, you know, doesn't leave a child hopelessly depressed, right? If you open an adult book, you may wind up with a very unhappy ending, right?
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
And I'm not sure that children particularly, you know, at some point they go through this kind of transition where they're able to do that kind of, okay, what kind of genre am I in? What does that mean about the story, what the story is likely to be? But mm-hmm. I think for one of the big differences is children experience a story without necessarily that safety blanket or that safety net that adult, I use the term safety blanket.
Right.
It's interesting here. But the kind of safety net that adults do that they don't necessarily, you know, I know
they don't
that
see the good ending coming.
Right. They don't. And I think part of that is it allows them to become much more invested in the story. Now, you mentioned something a second ago. You talked about story beats. And I suspect that there's something about what a graphic novel is or a comic is that has to do with the visuals of that comic book and story beats that differentiates it from, say, a book with illustrations. So what do you mean by story beats in the context of a graphic novel?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, we were talking about the difference between a graphic novel and a picture book. And just to lay the groundwork there, you know, the difference between it's the difference between illustrated prose and comics. And comics, to me, comics is when these words and pictures are working even more closely together than prose and illustration. Prose and illustrations, you have a block of prose and you have a picture. And picture books, really good picture books, like Where the Wild Things Are and you know, these classic ones, you know, they are mixed. The prose and the pictures are all together and laid out beautifully, but they still are separate. With comics, you know, these two things, words and pictures, are combined just about as closely as they can be. And then the other thing that makes comics comics is the sequentiality of the art, lining one image after another, and giving a sense of time to those images. So you read through the images and the story moves in time. And then the other question we were talking about, that now that I've laid that groundwork, what was the other part of the question again?
Well, you've met one of the things that, so you started to get into it now, I think, because you had mentioned in passing the notion of the beats of the story.
That's right. Yes. That's what I was going to tell you. To me, there's a lot of crossover between comics and film, or when I think about, when you're laying out a graphic novel, when you're thumbnailing pages, it's a funny experience because, you know, you write your story, and I think all stories have beats to them, have emotional beats, have turns and things like you get to this certain point and you want things to flip and then flip again, you know, situations. But the other thing about comics is where to me it has like an overlap with film is, you know, I'm working in panels, and a lot of times I'm thinking about camera angles. I think of the panels in terms of camera angles, or me in this space, and this panel is a window into this thing, and where do I want to place that window? You know, if I'm looking at Zita, is she very confident? Should I have the camera slightly looking up at her, so, you know, she's standing proud and tall almost above us, or is she feeling, you know, lonely and weak? Should I bump that camera up so it's looking down on her and we see how small she is in the world? And then broadly, I plan out my stories. I'm learning to plan out my stories more in advance and take more care to work with the architecture of the story, because when I talk about beats, like you are leading your audience through a tale, and you want them to, you know, hit certain emotional notes at certain times, whatever, you know, following along with whatever theme you're doing. I don't know. So all of those things kind of gel together to be an important whole.
I really wish, as we were talking, you know, this were what do they call it? An enhanced podcast. So it could actually be showing some examples of what you're talking about from the book.
Oh yeah.
You know, it's funny. So Stuart Kaufman, who blogs at Lawyers, Guns, and Money, is an academic, and he talks about this notion of visual rhetoric. And he spends a lot of time both on scene composition from television and film, and also composition from comic books and graphic novels.
Yeah.
And what you're saying really, it's interesting. I mean, well, films are storyboarded, aren't they, in general? So, I mean, isn't
a lot of them are, and comics are similar. And my style of, I mean, not all comics really have to be. The comics have a broad range of what you can do with them. And I just feel like, personally, my style is a little bit cinematic. I lean towards the cinematic approach. You can do, I don't do a whole lot of interesting, like when we the old Spirit, Will Eisner's Spirit, comics, you know, they would start out with a real physical, like the title itself, the Spirit was existing in space, you know, and he might be walking by, his own title of his comic, and you could do some really cool meta things with comics. But I just kind of, not consciously, but almost unconsciously, just don't do a lot of that. I treat it like more like a film. So,
but the things you were talking about, that, I mean, this is why I brought up this notion of visual rhetoric, because some of the things you're talking about I find really interesting. The idea that we sort of, I think that a lot of people who don't have any background in this, and I think about this because one of the things I do in my science fiction classes, my students read Watchmen, which is obviously a fairly complicated and engaged graphic novel.
Yeah.
And they're not used to reading graphic novels. They read text primarily, and we read primarily text in the story, although we do, I mean, in the class. But how difficult it is for them to sort of pick up on the kinds of things that you would pick up, that they are have more facility on picking up in text. So things that you're talking about, the way that you might use the equivalent of a camera angle perspective to actually communicate important information through the book, that to me is really interesting, right? And I was flipping through it as you're talking about that, and there is a sequence where there's one panel where you have these close-ups, these underviews, and then you pull up to an extreme distance shot, right?
Yeah.
And there's in the way that that's engaged in storytelling, I mean, what other kinds of things do you do besides close-ups or distant shots to provide information that might otherwise be provided through text?
Yeah, well, let's see. Gesture is I think of the characters as actors, and well, I mean, there's establishing shots. Every so often, you need to remind the reader where they are. Mm-hmm. You can't just do the characters. Sometimes panels come. You know, sometimes dialogue. If you know who's speaking, you can have dialogue come. Do tricks like having dialogue come from off panel while you're showing something else. But I'm a huge geek for gesture. I like to make sure that I'm telling as much of storytelling as I can through the characters' body languages. And I like, I like trying to show actual kinetic movement through comics. Like you should have, I feel like I have an idea of how these characters move through space, each of them differently. Like if you're running, like, you know, Madrigal has a way of running. Madrigal's more physical than Piper is, and Zeta charges forward probably with more power than Grace. Joseph it moves timidly. One zips around, even though he's a big orb and he's a little bit heavy.
Can you back up a second? So our listeners have no idea who these characters are.
Oh, sorry. And maybe it doesn't even matter. It's just like how I'm looking at these different characters. I was talking about mostly these characters are human, the ones I mentioned, except for one who is a big round robot.
Right.
But just as different body types, I like to think about how they move. And but also keeping an eye to showing as much emotional information and as much of that through body language as possible. I love it's really cool when the words and the pictures can both be telling maybe different things, like I don't know. There's a moment in the first book when they're going to try to break into this castle where Zeta's on an alien planet and her friend Joseph has been captured, and they're for reasons that I don't know if we need to get into right now, that, you know, he's going to be part of a human sacrifice that they think is going to save their planet. And Zeta and her ragtag band are trying to get into this castle, and it's heavily guarded. And one, who's this kind of floating round robot who's all about battle and war, he says, "Oh, we need to use a frontal assault." And like, I'm trying to show you just a circle with eyes, really. And I'm trying to show, at that moment, like how excited he is to just charge into battle, you know. But you can also go the other way. You can have somebody saying one thing, but their body saying something different, you know. With Piper and Madrigal, who are the only two adult human characters, at one point. Oh, actually, yeah, it's actually from the third book. Now you're going to get like a little hint of this third book. But at one point, they kind of operate like ex-boyfriend and girlfriend or a divorced couple or something like this, because like,
well, you signpost that in the second
a little bit, yeah. But at one point when you finally see them together, they're arguing, but you know, like their hips are like slightly drawn towards each other, like, you know, their body gestures are a little bit drawn together, even though you know, their faces are turned away from each other, you know, so you can tell there this is like this tension that I'm trying to build just through body language. So anyway, I really like that a lot. I like to think of my characters as actors and trying to draw different things out of them. I don't even know where I started. Now I'm just geeking out about comics, which is what I do when you get me going.
Well, that's the whole point of these things, because it's much more interesting to listen to you geek out about comics than to listen to me ask questions or do elaborate setups that are just designed to get you to geek out. So you talk about, you know, so it's funny, you're talking about geeking out about comics, but my vague memory is that you have a more classical art training. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, comics is something that's special to me, but I really am all over the place. I've always wanted to write and illustrate. That's something that I've kind of always had in my heart, and I've always loved comics. But, when I was first starting out, I was doing, freelance illustration. I was just doing any kind of job I could find. And, I was all through, you know, growing up in school, I was basically a self-taught artist, and that went really well. I feel like I missed out on a lot of collaborations. I haven't learned to work artistically well with others. But I learned a lot on my own, and that was really good. But there came a point when I was doing art professionally, and I felt like I reached a point where I couldn't get better or couldn't get better fast enough to get to where I wanted to be without some kind of training. And at that time I was really into, you know, painting and classical art and stuff like this, and kind of the more academic side of things. And one thing led to another, and I was able to do some courses at the Cecil Studios in Florence. We got to go overseas to Italy, and I spent a summer there, and then a subsequent summer studying painting, but a real academic style of painting, like kind of like the old masters, basically what John Singer Sargent does, really working from life, working from plaster casts, stuff like this. It's really academic. Really, to me, it was just loads of fun, and I still love painting, but the biggest thing was when I got back, just in all the different art that I was working on, there was just a real palpable improvement. And so I'd become kind of a believer in doing, you know, if you're doing anything related to the arts, to the visual arts anyway, that a lot of life drawing is going to be really good for you. So that's important to me. And you know, as much as I love comics, I finished up a picture book recently that will be out next year. And that's a different format. You know, that's writing and illustrating working together differently than in comics. So I'm a little bit all over the place.
So what's the name of the picture book that's coming out?
Oh, the picture book is called Julia's House. Mm-hmm. And it's about a girl who kind of opens up makes her house into like a halfway house for creatures that nobody believes in. So like not quite a homeless shelter, because it's more, or not quite a, yeah, not quite an animal shelter, but more of a homeless shelter. And so she puts a sign outside her door that says Julia's House for Lost Creatures. And then they all show up, all the like trolls and a mermaid and a dragon and a bunch of goblins and all these things show up, and they have a real hard time living together. It's much more than she expected. And you know, it's fun.
Now, are you the author of that as well?
Yeah. So I wrote and illustrated that, and that's going to be out after Zeta 3, unfortunately. But that was just a blast to put together, because you know, I wrote this story, and then I did all the sketches for it, and then I ended up doing it as watercolors, mm-hmm. and those were just so fun to paint. I had a good time.
Oh, you know, I was thinking about the my daughter's favorite. Picture books were all watercolors, so looking forward to that.
It's really beautiful.
So how did you get then from doing the classical training, the from life picture drawing? How did you move from that phase to actually coming out with this, you know, rather successful graphic novel?
So the other thing I was into at the time was, I had found on the internet, there was a forum, the Flight Forums. I don't know if you remember the Flight Anthologies. They were collections of comics from various artists. And they all kind of shared a similar, I don't even know, that, not even a theme, but more of an aesthetic kind of similarity. And it's a really interesting group of young artists. Some of them were like storyboard artists for DreamWorks, or... You know, everybody came from different backgrounds, and I found these guys online and, you know, started posting comics on the forums. And it was like, having missed art school, that, you know, that collaborative thing of, you know, sharing work with sharing your ideas and stuff like this. This was kind of filling in that gap for me, was posting comics and pictures online on this forum, and having people, you know, say like, oh, that's great. Or, oh, that looks real Photoshop-y, try harder. And so it was really great. It was a good experience for me to do this. And then, and eventually, like, they were like, hey, why don't you contribute a comic for our next, for volume two of Flight? And I was like, really? This will be great. And so I did some work for Flight 2 and Flight 3, a short story for each of those. And then I did I actually did a Zeta story. Okay, so simultaneously, a lot of what I was posting there was Zeta the Space Girl web comics. And those were three-page stories that I was working on. Basically, I like this. So Kazu Kibuishi, right? He was the editor of the Flight anthologies, and he was working on a web comic called Copper, which you can still find at boltcity.com. It's a great little web comic. He wasn't doing them very often. I think he was trying to do one a month, and they were like one-page comics. And he had made a comment that he was doing these so he could like tighten up his storytelling, so he could do, kind of improve his comicking. And so I thought, I'll do the same thing with this character, Zeta the Space Girl, and I'll do these little three-page stories. And I did. For a while, that was going really well. But I never explained what this girl was doing traveling through space. They were really just like little vignettes. So between that and the Flight books, I finally thought, like, oh, I should tell the story of how this girl got out here. And a couple people, saw the web comics and approached me about some smaller publishers approached me about doing a Zeta graphic novel, and it kind of got the wheels turning. And then eventually I started emailing publishers, and having done the Flight books, since I don't know if they were huge sellers, but they were critically loved, or appreciated anyway. But having a story in those helped me kind of get a foot in the door. I could email them and say, I did stories for the Flight anthology. I was wondering if I could send along, this graphic novel idea. And they were like, oh, sure. And that's how I ended up at First and Second. So
our listeners may know, it's Kibuishi. How do you say his name?
Kibuishi.
They might know him through Flight or through Copper, which has had a physical release, or they might know him through Amulet, which has been a very successful.
His big books are the Amulet books.
Yeah,
definitely.
Those are with Scholastic.
And now he's doing the new edition of Harry Potter. The covers for that.
Cool.
Which I haven't seen them in print or anything, but from what I've seen, from the little snippets I've seen, they look really cool.
Well, that's delaying the next volume of Amulet. I know some people are going to be very disappointed about that.
Yeah.
But you mentioned that Zeta made her first non-virtual appearance, and it was in Flight Explorer Volume 1. Is that right?
Yeah. And that was a really silly story, but sometimes I still look back on it and like it. Some of my earlier stuff I'm a little embarrassed by. Mm-hmm. But that Zeta story, I think, kind of still holds up.
Well, Flight Explorer was was Flight, but it was aimed at all ages, as you would say.
Yeah, maybe a more all ages, because a couple of Flight stories, were a little bit more adult.
Yeah, I picked it up and decided that I wasn't going to pass that along quite.
Yeah. the Flight Explorer, and now they're doing volumes of something they're just calling Explorer, mm-hmm. and they've dropped the Flight, but it's really the same, basic pool of artists.
Right. There's one that's a boxer.
Foxes. Yeah. That's the first one. Yeah.
Which it's interesting. My daughter just is not that interested in. Maybe there's something about the call of Flight, that.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
So you then got into, one of the things that you mentioned during this discussion that I don't know very much about, but I found very interesting is, back when I was a kid, way much longer ago than I want to admit. I primarily would encounter there was no internet. There were basically fanzines of various sorts, some of which were no better than bigger than pamphlets. And then there was the comic book store, and those were the places where you would go to get this kind of entertainment. But I've only in the last few years have become aware of the massive explosion of web comics.
Okay.
And I'm curious and I know that you said that you did some stuff that are web comics that you mentioned Copper being developed in part through a web comic exercise. And I read some of the big ones, I guess in the fantasy genre, Girl Genius and Gunner Creek Court and things like that. What role has that played in the industry and in the development of the art form in the community?
It's not something I really keep up with other than my own, you know, things that I like to read and then my personal experiences. And my personal experience has been that, you know, I finally had a place where I could find an audience, and that was humongous. Like, you know, growing up in Indiana, I could draw comics to entertain my friends, and that was really good. And I learned a lot about, like, how to do that through that. But really being able to, like, there's a nice instant gratification to web comics because, you could put it out there and later that day or almost instantly you can have comments and people and getting reactions it's a way of training. I mean, you have to live, the downside is you have to live with your early work. It's sometimes very rough early work. You know, it'll exist on the internet forever, but it's really, really opened up the world to more cartoonists. I don't know how it's affected, how it affects like the industry. Especially because I hover in a funny place in the industry because I'm not, I'm more into the children's book and library side of things than I am the Comic-Con, you know, side of things and pop culture side of things. But it's a really interesting phenomenon. I learned so much from doing webcomics online, even though I didn't even do, you know, comparative to some that many webcomics. I didn't do that much. Another thing that I get a lot out of and that I enjoy a lot and enjoy seeing others do is like, I wouldn't even call it a comics journal, but I do like when I can, I do, like journal comics, web comics about my own experiences. And that's just another fun way to connect to people. But I don't know how it affects the print industry as much. It's an interesting question.
You have a great illustration at the back of the two books, the About the Author, which shows you with your extensive family.
Yeah.
So you have four girls, is that right?
I do, yeah.
Mm-hmm. That must be quite a handful. It must also help that you are in a vocation where you work at home.
Yeah, it's a help and a hindrance to work at home with four daughters hanging around. They do check on me periodically through the day. It's nice to have. They're like my first line of. They're like my first editorial line of critique, and they can easily come in here and see if what I'm doing is funny or not funny or interesting or confusing or whatever. So that's on the one hand very helpful. On the other hand, I've found that, you know, a pair of good headphones and loud music is like the best thing in my office, you know, because there's a lot going on in my house now. Mm-hmm. It's a very busy place.
So I had two more questions I wanted to ask before I let you go, and you've been
sure,
very
sure.
generous with your time. Actually, I think I have three. It's like the Spanish Inquisition, 4, 5, 6.
Let's go for it.
But so one was, you know, so this is New Books in Science Fiction and Fantasy, and I'm fairly generous about what I call new. We're sort of between, you know, this Legends of Zeta the Space Girl, I guess, was new when we initially talked, and
yeah.
You're going to have the next one coming out. So I think that works.
Okay.
But I'm curious about the decision to do this is science fiction or speculative fiction or fantasy, depending on how much we want to police the genres.
Right.
Obviously, this isn't hard science fiction.
Right.
And the picture book that you described, which sounds wonderful, is, you know, fantasy.
Yeah.
So I'm curious about why those genres, because nothing you've said so far indicates, you know, that besides the C.S. Lewis quotation suggests, you know, that.
Oh, you mean like lifelong fandom of the genres
yeah,
or what?
Something? What made you get into to doing stuff in these genres?
Oh, gosh. I mean, it's just what I've lived and breathed. So, you know, since I was a really bookish kid and It depends on if you want to go to like I both read books and when I could got I mean comics came along a little later for me, but I grew up with my parents reading to me the standards, the Chronicles of Narnia, the Roald Dahl books, James and the Giant Peach, and all of these, and we went through I would go through Lloyd Alexander's Chronicles of Prydain, and little bit of sci-fi too. I remember when somebody finally handed me Ender's Game, and that was like a real watershed moment. So I've always, it's just been something I've been drawn to basically forever, that and superheroes, which I haven't really dabbled in as much. I mean, I don't really consider Zeta a superhero.
Well, but Zeta is, part of one of the underlying currents in the plot is that, she's this, there is a superhero-like structure.
Yeah,
she's average
true.
Girl.
That's true. That's true. Yeah.
She falls into a situation where she takes on, she has a cape, she has an outfit, she takes on the role of a superhero. And
yeah.
Part of what you're
she's
playing
got
with
the trappings, definitely, yeah.
And part of what you're playing with in the second book is the fact that she is this tension that she's fundamentally a normal girl, but she's viewed by some as a superhero and she has to do super heroic things.
Yes, and so maybe I should backtrack a little bit on that. I guess, I have this, thing where I think real superheroes are superheroes that exist on Earth, and which is weird because that excludes people like I wouldn't think like the Silver Surfer. Mm-hmm. No, not really a superhero to me. Like he's speeding around in space, but I realize that that's not really that doesn't really work quite well to just have your superheroes on Earth. But no, you're right. And it does. It plays a lot with that. I like the stories that examine who's real. Is Bruce Wayne the real guy or is Batman the real guy? I like Clark Kent to be, the real person. I like him being actually kind of semi-socially awkward guy who is freed. Or like Peter Parker is a great example. Like, He gains a lot of confidence by putting on this mask and persona, and all of a sudden he's joking and taunting people and stuff like this. When as Peter Parker, he might be a little bit when as himself, he's a little more awkward. But yeah, so and then like oh, and then with comics, going back to growing up reading genre stuff, one of the coolest things when I finally was growing up in Indiana, when I was finally one of the most liberating things, when I was finally old enough to be allowed to ride my dirt bike, blocks and blocks up the road, there was a used bookstore, and my mom would just let me just jump. Like I must have been like, because we moved when I was just turned 13, so this was probably when I was 11 or 12. She just let me jump on my dirt bike and ride blocks and blocks away to a used bookstore that sold just everything. But I would just pour through the old comics, and I got onto ElfQuest. I don't know if you know about ElfQuest by Wendy and Richard Pini. And that I would go back every week and see if they had new or if anybody else tried it. Because many, many issues long, telling one long questing story about these elves trying to find out where they came from. And I would just go back and try to fill in more bits of the story with these back issues. And so that was a big deal for me. I was into Tolkien so much that when I was in grade school, I think I was in like sixth grade, and we had to do a book report, and I did The Hobbit, and I made this elaborate costume with a staff that I had carved to try to have Gandalf's face on it and stuff. And I had my big like plasticky glasses on. But I had this like hooded cloak, and I got up and I like recited the songs from the book. I think I actually was singing the song from the Rankin Bass, Hobbit cartoon. And then I was singing this song, and I got halfway through the song and I realized that like, I'm the only kid who's gotten into this book report thing. I'm the only kid who dressed up. I'm the only kid singing. And I got halfway through the song and like all the kids were looking at me, and I could still feel my face, like that rush of like blood to your face where you're like starting to like blush and like get really nervous. And then, cause I think all the kids thought I was a big dork, but it was that, but that's, I mean, this is the thing. It's like, to me, it was like, oh, this is the coolest thing I could possibly do is dress up in this outfit that I made and bring the staff to school and sing this song. And then I like halfway through the song, I realized, wait a minute, this is not cool at all. But anyway, yeah. So, I mean, I was reading a lot. I was really reading a lot growing up.
Mm-hmm. So one last question then I'm not going to ask my 13, because that's such a great story to kind of do as our penultimate thing.
Yeah, sure, totally.
So the Legends of Zeta the Space Girl begins with a the epigraph is, and I think I've gotten the right epa there, but maybe not, is from Hilaire Belloc.
Yeah.
I was hoping you might tell us a little bit about the choice of him and of that quotation.
Yeah, well, the first book begins with a Chesterton quote, and I am kind of a Chesterton nut, and that kind of sums up the series for me. But the Belloc quote, I think, because I really am into the journey, the idea of a journey, and the idea that a lot of the Zita ends up being about the pull between your friends and home. But Belloc, I think at the time was one of it, and still is. I really like his writing, but he was kind of in a way, a travel writer, or spent some of his time doing that. And, I don't know, it's just from a book called The Path to Rome, which he was a young guy and he decided he was going to walk to Rome, from France, I think is where he started out, and take, no, and use no wheeled object. He would accept rides on no wheel. He had all these like ideas, these like high ideals of how he was going to do this journey. And then he broke at like almost every one of his resolutions on his way, just trying to get there. And, I don't know. It's about starting out this journey with these high ideals and like how hard it ends up being. And, I don't know. It's hard to explain why that quote and not others. But I like starting books out with quotes. That's a big deal for me.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. The books are just really terrific, and I hope that both people who enjoy the medium already and those who maybe have been interested in getting the medium will check them out. You mentioned the third book is coming out maybe as early as January and February of 2014. You have a picture book that's coming out. Are there any plans for what's next?
Yeah, there are plans for what's next. It looks like, I have some, I've been doing a series of robot comics on my blog. And they're just, it's me getting back into the comic strip format, which is fun. It's kind of, to me, the comic strips, you know, like the newspaper strip format is more like the poetry of comics, because you're working with a very small space, you know. And telling us a poignant idea in a small space, right? And so I kind of got back into that by doing these robot comics. I didn't expect to do – well, I just did the first one just as an idea to dash off an idea and put on my blog. And now there's between 25 and 30 of them that I've been chipping away at. And this little robot has taken on like a greater and greater personality as he's gone. I think it looks like the next book I'll be working on will be a. I mean, it's not official yet, but it looks like the next book I'm going to be working on will be a story about this little robot. And you can see who he is by going to the blog, I think, checking out the little robot comics.
We'll make sure we'll put a link into the page that has the podcast embedded on it. So
yeah, and I'll send you a link to all those little comics. And that's going to be another, like, all ages. Mm-hmm. But it might be geared a little bit more towards early readers. I've got an idea for how comics, that's a whole nother topic we could get into, but comics as reading tools. Mm-hmm. My daughter learned to read basically through picking up Calvin and Hobbes. And, you know, at one point early on, she was like, I hate reading. I don't want to read. And she was kind of having a hard time with it, but we'd let her take the Calvin and Hobbes books and just sit in bed and read, look at the Calvin and Hobbes books. And she would start out by telling us what Calvin did. And then eventually she started telling us what Calvin said. And then we realized, oh, you know, she just taught herself to read. That's how that works. So anyway, it got me thinking about comics as tools for early readers and how to craft a comic that can help along the early readers.
Well, you know, I think that's right, and I'm thinking back to some of my own experiences with my daughter or with, you know, kids her age, her friends and peers. But I also think it's really important to remind people that, you know, it used to be that people would say, oh, you start out on comics and then, you know, you graduate from them. But I think there's a growing realization that there is no graduation, or there shouldn't be, that that it is an art form, and that it is, as we would say, it's non-indexical, that actually learning to read comics in the kind of in the various idioms that you describe them is, in fact, a form of literacy.
Yeah.
So that's terrific. But I also know that the flip side of that is it is a gateway. And
yes, I think so too.
So that's terrific. I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah.
And thanks again for your time. And maybe when something comes out in the future, you'll be willing to do this again.
I certainly will. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This episode of New Books in Science Fiction and Fantasy was recorded on June 20th, 2013. Thanks for tuning in.